Okay, thank you for this introduction. So, this is a poem called This House. Conducting rain to scourge ground, sodden and mudlogged, trailing sheets of it by a house and in off the sea. At the tail end of November, winter's suddenly here and furious for having been forgotten. Now it's taking fury out on the unborn. All it wants to do is drown the pale, bald head of the day. So I wake in a gale that's flaking rain against the unlit glass of my eyes, that stuffs down my ears a sound that's a squall, rip-roaring on the high seas. Though when I went to bed, I was on land. By now, wind has countersunk my ears to hear nothing but winter shouting out all other sounds. On a rattly rigging of iron up and 8-foot boards across, I try to thaw into my rounds of a drifting house. Out on deck alone, I am the lookout who planks a crow's nest of sorts. And I am the first. Already, weather has banged all the angles out of last night. I fix another plank above my head to climb higher for a better look about, to get over slates at eaves that piss down like a row of taps left on. But every time I lunge another leg of scaffold skyward, I see nothing but smouldering horizons, watery red, beaten out by steady downpour. And rain is pressure-driven down the sleeves of my oils. Rain has taken on the plastering of walls and chimneys. With all its wet weight, it slams doors and windows on a house full of men in trades. Drags heavy curtains of its standing gallons past. I'm frightened to the point of understanding that we may as well turn round. But know that being this far out now means capsizing. And this house is sure to founder. Shipwreck on the home stretch for one, but the maiden voyage of another. I'll say that quite a few of these poems in the book, Anchor Measurements, are about the building trade, and I could have written lots of stuff about negative equity and shoddy workmanship and houses being built on floodplains and people losing their homes and all this, but I didn't really. Like, I chose to write about more positive things because I was writing from the point of view of somebody who just did a job that I enjoyed doing and that I wanted to do as well as I could, and in which I wanted to learn all the time. I just wanted to learn more things. So, and that's it. The next poem is called, it's called Gradual. And this is a poem for Tom and Mick Fitzgerald, whom I used to work with. I was a carpenter. Gradual. Constant building makes an architect of the mason. It's a Turkish proverb. From the ground up, this house was teaching me. In the beginning, there was a shovel, a work-dulled hand-me-down, missing half its handle. For banking 8 of sand and 16 gravel in the back of the mixer. A bag of cement, jabbed split, fumbles past the spinning lip last. And shoveling sand is not the same as shoveling gravel. The man on gravel shovels and strains twice as hard. Concrete sloshes itself into itself. The brimming drum lists from all this throwing its weight around. A tilt-turning vat of muck brought up over our boots from Monday all the way to Saturday sometimes. but you soon see where you fit in and put the mess to rights. Smack down and drag along the straightest timber's edge. Turn a lumpy field into a sheet of glass. Now, for as long as some mother and father's pilgrimage back and forth of the small hours may go on, our floor, set but 4 inches thick, will serve its purpose between the 4 great walls of their purchase. And I'll do the title poem from the book, Accurate Measurements, which is again about simply just doing the job that I used to love. Accurate Measurements. No one ever got the hanging of a door right first time round. That's what makes it beautiful to go back to time and again. You can almost grasp who came before you by how the frame is cast in the mason's block on edge. Eyeball it for plumb in proper pencil marks. Feel it up for haphazard handsaw cuts. Tell somebody's casual endeavour from a ceremony where nothing is accidental. You could spend the morning fiddling with a jack plane, worrying about taking too much off one side of a door. In the end, it's all in the correct housing of the hinge. A chisel's whetted lip and hammer, staking out their right of way, clunk by clunk. And flakes of feathered wood fall to ground, crackle on their boots. Cavities puffed clean, into which the cool obliging brass will sit. Manhandled into the jams, it's a barrier mid rooms of industry and ease. The master comes checking up on a past pupil, the thickness of a coin between your toil and his. The fitting of the locks, snug if done squarely. We've moved along from the quiet elegance of brace and bit to shooting 220 bolts of hot-augured steel, whining and thrashing into the stile. The stile popping up lumps of itself in the rout. But signs of horseplay are hidden in the finish, and putting on handles is dainty work. Hung accurately, a door doesn't just close. Made to measure, it clicks into place. And some carpenters hang their best door in a bathroom. Others shine in toilets, mindful of those who will sit there later, relieving themselves, taking it all in.
So some advertisement.
So, I won't do all the building poems because they're probably only for free builders in there.
Yeah.
I'll just do this one because this is about the joy of working with tools that are good tools or that run well. Because in this case, it's a Husqvarna. So this one is called a chainsaw. Perfect putting, grumbling idle between knockdown rounds. The Husqvarna has lived up to a neighbour's laudation. Spend on a saw as savage as that, and you'll not go short logging any of the woods in the county. So let her glug glug good juice until the trigger's pulled and she farts out loud of sluggishness. Let her glut precision parts with hot sawdust and her own oil dribbling. Isn't cleaning after binges the least that I can do? True to those words, not once did she hum or haw, but always like snarling watchdogs set upon intruders' bare legs. No tree here stands a chance. A mob of teeth chisels that go from some to hundreds in a hundredth of a second can be sent to rip a trunk's insides out for a sniff of petrol. And from every tug that wakes her, sputtering and maddened, to the cold hours on the bench under rag and rasp, she lives out reckless lives of her own. Now the face cut's done, the saw swallowing and spitting its chain, legs locked, strut fast in an upturned V. I'll steer that riot of steel into the back of another tree. And okay, so I'll move along to something else. So I got some poems from Connemara. I don't know if you know a place called Letterfrack. I've been there a few times, and they have there's a lovely hostel there called the Nord Monastery, and across the road from the hostel there's a graveyard. Even black gaze, and you go up the path through all the wild garlic, and you go through, and then you arrive at this graveyard. And if you go in and look, it's where all the boys were buried. And I mean, if you just look at the dates and the born, died, I mean, it's a very sad place. All these boys that were in the care of the church, I suppose, the Christian Brothers. And so this first one is called. So I wrote a few poems when I was there, and this first one is called Boys and Their Toys. Now you have marble hearts, and the name of every boy failed at Letterfrack, where there were only slabs fat-faced with moss saying nothing. They've cut in granite black, the age of each child swept under the grass. But one, when digging a hole was easier than being exact, Walter Futter died as a young boy, 1910. A lead soldier breaks from too much bending. A lead soldier's thrown back in the pan from melting. And miniature cars left in lieu of flowers mean some, as young as 8, will never grow up. Here, 1918 was an ugly year, only weeks between burials, if disguising evidence in Christian rigmarole could be called burial. At one end of the mass grave, a stone cross in white is still standing. At the other, a stout pillar holds the gate, where someone had the bright idea of setting an Irish 5-pence piece. They stuck its tails up in the drying cement. So, somewhere between the stone of that cross and the harp's metal lies or imperishable history beneath toys. The cut and dried story of all those boys. And there's a poem that goes with it. And in the book it's in inverted commas, because it's something that I heard somebody say as a friend, and not in these exact words. So I called this poem. Because I should say the girl actually grew up in that area, so she knew when I described the graveyard, she knew exactly what I was talking about, because she used to actually hang around and play there with her friends when she was young. So this one is called Innocence Overheard. Two girls and I would pick wild garlic and go there to play a game. The first find a date of birth on the stone hearts the same as or close to that day's date, should lie on the ground before the heart, they're green and white, and cry that birthday found. Until, of course, we heard they were dates on which each boy died, and feeling there was something that had lied, we played something else. So I think it's the Mercy, just pretty close to here, and I'd like to read a poem. My friend of mine, his dad died in the Mercy a couple of years ago, and I was there in the room in which he died, and I wrote a poem about that. So I think I checked it out, and I think the Mercy, or at the entrance to the Mercy, is Henry Street. So I call the poem Sunlight, Henry Street, and this is in memory of Derry O'Sullivan from Yall. All I want to do, all I want is to wake once more with sunlight fooling in every corner of this room. No shutters, no blinds, no curtains that trick you into thinking it's still night, or night already, when it isn't yet, but is soon, and for good. Then you can go back to the grind, fell the shadows of fountains up city streets, luster low tides, diamond high mountains. Okay. So I wasn't sure what to read, and I realised that there are a few people here, a couple of people here, who would appreciate one of these poems in the book. So I'm going to read this one, and there's a bit of a story behind the poem, because you'll have to help me if I get it wrong. I live in France, and often when I come back and I go down to Yall, and I stay with my mum's place, and there's a few jobs need to be done, shelf falls down, or there's a hole in the foot battery, or something is broken. And on this occasion, she told me that the wardrobe was falling apart in her bedroom, and she had bought, is that right? She bought or seen a new wardrobe in Cork City, and said to her sister, "Let's go up and pick up the wardrobe." And so they got into the car and they went up to Cork City, and they had sold it to somebody else. Is that right? when they arrived up, they sold it to somebody else. So they said, "Well, what are we going to do? I mean, we're left with this crock of a thing in the bedroom," and they sold a new one. So I said, "Well, I mean, maybe I could fix it." So I did fix it, and I wrote the poem about it, and the poem is called Her and That Wardrobe. That's what the next man is here. You can't see it, but actually it's her and that wardrobe, like there's a thing in there. I enjoy it. So here we go. At first glance, that wardrobe was good for firewood, for the havoc of a quick hammering in the yard below and best burned by Christmas. What had you there but a pair of run-down doors to hide the old outfits. A bottom so Swiss cheesed woodworm, they could hardly keep a drawer off the floor. A heap of neglect against the bedroom wall. But when taken in hand, it was not that. When rubbed down with a steaming cloth, it started to tell of something else. A few worm-plundered planks replaced, dry joints rooted out for squeezing in new glue, and a pair of handles would set it off again. So you took it outside on a fine day in August. Chisels hard ablaze, and the blade of a saw kept warm all day. Soaked in preserver, stray wormholes turned fumaroles. That evening, it was back in its corner, stinking of a workover, with all the signs of the gears you'd added on. Or was it those it now claimed back? Her Saturday readying herself in its glass, a door open to shuffle through and choose one dress for two, find the earrings to go with, swinging to time as if time meant forever. The drawer always slightly open, the flash and frill of unmentionables. And won't you return here in a year to see the ass fallen from another drawer? Won't you come back to take out tools and attempt the impossible? Start speaking from the hands again, your dumb language wanting to promise everything? Okay, I'll do a poem for Corinne, who's not here, but she was here last time. We came here about 5 months ago. We got her in Spanish, and she was here on holidays, and she took part in the Five Words Challenge, and I thought she should have won it. So. I don't know who would.
You did not
write
people.
Yeah, Paul won the Five Words
Challenge. Sorry, Adam.
And
if he comes back, I'll lose. Recently.
Because she loves dragonflies, and one of the five words is dragonfly. So she wrote a killer poem about dragonflies. So for Corinne, who's not here, I'll write a poem about when we met. Again, it's a Connemara poem. We met in Galway, and then we knew each other from Galway, and then I think we met really on Inishbofin, was where we kind of really, I suppose, we really noticed each other when we were in Inishbofin. Okay, so this one is called An Awakening. Last night on the island, Brendan waving a knife, dishing out bloody pollock over a slow game of chess. Barely out of the waves, he had them in the pan. I set bait to have the queen reeled in, but was checked by the advance of morning. The rising tide could ferry us out of unfinished business. Just in time, the thick-set skipper teased through his water-tightened beard, and lubberly we reeled onto rolling boards, launched bags down from Boffin's new pier. As the vessel made knots, ploughed graceful lines through the dull might of trough and crest, the group spread out absently, abaft, starboard, and some towards the bow. But I stood there like a seeking compass, lost to your constant tacking. Nearing Cliggan, someone came out of the bridge, or safe debarkation laid to his charge. Islands are great places to meet people, he said, gesturing back across the sound. Offered me a pocket map of the island where I had just met you. I would like to read the last poems from this, so new poems. So I have two new poems. I live in France now. It's near Le Havre. It used to go to the ferry from Ireland, but you can't anymore. You have to go to Cherbourg, I think. And I went there recently, and we call it the Hanging Gardens. This is a park, really, with loads of plants. And so this is actually the most recent poem, so it's fresh off the pen. This one is called The Austral Garden. It is said that humans are never satisfied, that you give them one thing and they want something more. And this is said in disparagement, whereas it is one of the greatest talents the species has. That was Steinbeck in The Pearl. There's a quote. Once you're up there, you'll know what payback really is. That it was worth every steep second of climbing to stand in the austral garden, if only to overhang the stretching out grey of the city. But there's so much more to it than that. There's a blend in the air of some unknown teas and salt off the English Channel. High up here, a strip of Australian scrub shifted from the underside of the earth is sure as bedrock between your tired and travelling feet. Eucalyptus leaves are silvery. Tasmanian snowgrass and snowgum are right at home under summer's big sun. Long and narrow leaves are hung up like collections of arrowheads. Nothing like the wide as your open palm ones of our European beech, oak and sycamore. And they're all the time carefully adding to the acres. To the west they're transplanting new varieties of sorb and jasmine, a jaw-breaking jarrah, with a view of the Bay of the Seine melting into open sea, where the horizon of the rest of the world would hypnotize you until you're woken from the dream by the voice of a boy asking, "What else is there, Daddy? What else is there?" And you're ready for road again. And I'll finish with a poem going back again to the tools and the building and the this poem started out as one of those, you know, they say a bad workman blames his tools. So it started out as one of those poems, and then a couple of months ago I was cutting wood and I sprained my thumb really badly. I didn't go to the doctor, and it would have been fine in like 2 weeks maybe if I'd gone, but I didn't go, and my hand was, I couldn't do anything for about 4 months. So I was really pissed off about that. I couldn't write. I couldn't really do a lot. It's amazing what you can do with one hand. So it started out as a poem about the bad workman blames his tools, and it turned into something else. This poem is called all thumbs. Out cutting wood one Sunday afternoon, I stubbed my thumb and put it in my mouth to curse the tool into the pain. But when it swelled up useless, it came instead to be about the ins and outs of self-inflicting an injury. Struggling to get the last out of a rusty saw when another hung behind me, shiny new. Mulishly driving it hard enough until the downward finger folding follow through. Now, days were filling up with what couldn't be done because of a thumb. A splint on my good hand meant I couldn't slice a loaf or hold a razor right, even do up my shirt buttons or pull a shoelace tight. I could only see the clouds gathering in of what wasn't happening, till boredom or the dulling gist of such defeat got me to thinking. And that was just the start of it. What then of the business type who, recovering from overwork, must get up every morning into awkwardness, spend time at home and mess around with kids he doesn't know? What of the year in France the au pair spends, stumbling along in the thick cast of a foreign tongue, missing sunsets in Clare, the dog giving the paw, six stools pulled in round a table full of home cooking? It seems we have to learn the grace in accepting we don't force such revisions on ourselves if, at the time, it felt the wise decision. And to learn as well, in life and love, the losing out makes room for other things. And what if working with the head allows the heart speak louder than did the hands? Or the laughter of children puzzled by a jigsaw beats the kick of 9 to 5. What if your daughter falls for a language and never comes back to you? This happens too. Thank you very much.